KALW.
I'm wearing a dress that I got here at the hospital. It's a two-piece and the top is sequined.
A local hospital helps its teen patients forget about their illnesses for a night.
It's bright pink, which is kind of crazy. I don't usually wear pink, but I like immediately fell in love and I've gotten so many compliments.
Prom in the pediatric ICU. Then Oscar So White is back. We'll hear a high schooler's take on Asian American representation in Hollywood.
It takes a person in a position of power to hire an Asian American woman in a different kind of role.
And we've got a love story from the StoryCorps booth.
I just feel like we could be in any situation together and we could deal with it so well. A zombie apocalypse, I don't know, just anything.
I'm Hannah Baba and this is Cross Currents. At Oakland's Kaiser Medical Center, there's a big conference room in the basement. Most days, it doesn't look like much. Linoleum floors and high, flat ceilings. But one night a year, a giant disco ball hangs in the middle of the room, and those linoleum floors echo the laughter and chatter of hundreds of teenagers there to have a good time. It's the pediatric prom. The National Institutes of Health estimates that as many as one in five kids and teens in the U.S. suffer from chronic illness. For many, this means they miss out on some of the biggest milestones of adolescence. Kaiser Permanente puts on this annual event to help treat the social effects of these teens' illnesses. Michelle Pitcher has the story.
It's Saturday evening and Kaiser's hallways are full of life. The basement feels like a teenage dream. It's basically a one-stop shop for everything a prom-goer could want. There are volunteer hairdressers and makeup artists and racks of donated dresses.
Oh, that one's pretty.
I'm wearing a dress that I got here at the hospital.
That's Jade Lilly. It's her first time here.
It's a two-piece and the top is sequined. It's bright pink, which is kind of crazy. I don't usually wear pink, but someone saw it and said that they thought it would look good on me, so I tried it on and I like immediately fell in love. And I've gotten so many compliments.
Jade's here with her friend Megan. They and about 100 other teens, all patients with chronic illness or in recovery, are getting ready for the pediatric prom. For the last 5 years, Kaiser Oakland's put on this event. They invite over all the teens treated at the pediatric ICU from the previous year. The kids can bring guests and parents can tag along. In a lot of ways, it's just like any other prom. Everyone looks and feels awesome, like Jade's friend Megan.
My look tonight is a navy dress with a bun and, I don't know, makeup, yeah.
That's Megan being humble. She's wearing her hair in a bun with strands framing her face. Her navy blue dress hits at her ankles, and her jewel-encrusted shoes match her diamond-detailed belt. The shoes are hers, but she got the dress from the donation racks. Before the dance, Megan, Jade, and all the other teens crowd into the basement to get ready. In one room, Michelle Austin watches her 17-year-old daughter, Faith, get her eyeshadow done.
It's my baby girl, Faith, yeah, Faith Austin. This is her fourth one, fourth prom here. She's got four dresses now.
Michelle's sitting on the floor with her back against the wall, and she has a huge grin on her face. She has her head tilted to the side to get a better look at her daughter. I ask if she comes with Faith every year.
Of course. It's fun for her. She loves it, so I want to see her enjoying it, so it's a blessing.
One, two, three, smile. All right, one more. Awesome.
I sit down at a quiet table with 17-year-old Megan so she can give her feet a break. It's her fourth year attending the event.
So I've basically been here for the entire time.
Megan suffers from two chronic illnesses. She was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis 4 years ago. That means she has ulcers and inflammation in her digestive tract. Over the course of her treatment, she developed another condition called chronic fatigue syndrome.
It has heavily affected my teenage years.
The Mayo Clinic says social isolation is one of the symptoms.
I'm very exhausted a lot of the time, so like going to outing events, stuff like that, I have to reserve my energy, and I miss out on a lot of school, so I don't really get to socialize that much.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that 3 million adults in the U.S. have ulcerative colitis, but it's much harder to estimate how many kids and teens are suffering from the disease and any other chronic illness. Many young people don't have the words to describe their symptoms, or they're not taken seriously by health professionals. Megan said that even her friends didn't seem to understand what she was going through.
And whenever you try and talk to them about your disease, they kind of shut you down a lot. And they kind of like make you feel small and stuff like that. Like they try and give you advice when they don't know what they're talking about. And it's kind of like, don't worry, I've tried these things, or no, that's not going to work. Like, I don't think you understand. Like, you need to listen to me instead of just talking about what you think you know.
It got even harder after her illness forced her to quit her extracurriculars.
My freshman year, I joined cross country and track, and I found like a group of people I related to. But since I lost having that talent to run, I lost connection with them. And they're like, oh, you're so strong, like you're my role model. But their words didn't reflect their actions. So I was definitely outcasted from that, and I didn't really know where to belong.
For Megan, the social problems weren't the end. One medication she tried, a steroid, caused her to gain weight, among other physical side effects. She became unrecognizable to herself, and it destroyed her mental health.
It distorted my looks, and it took away my sense of self. You just don't feel like yourself. You don't look like yourself. And that depresses and makes you very anxious. So it drove me to the point I was very suicidal, and I tried to kill myself. And they got me off of it after 3 months. But still, like a month or two later, I was still dealing with the side effects of it because it was such a heavy medication on my body.
But Megan didn't have to go through it alone. She connected with Jade and other teens at a camp specifically for people with inflammatory bowel diseases, including Crohn's and ulcerative colitis.
We already have that sense of like connection because we all kind of understand that we're all going through some type of problem in our lives that's continuous. And you just kind of click together because of that.
She said these kinds of bonds are hard to find.
But like events like these, I feel like I'm at home and I'm very comfortable being myself and I'm very happy.
Many of the teens at the event have similar stories. But on the dance floor, they were just laughing and dancing and screaming along to a Katy Perry song. Their troubles take a backseat, and at least for the night, they're just teenagers having fun. In Oakland, I'm Michelle Pitcher for Cross Currents.
Michelle Pitcher is a student at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Last week, nominations for the 92nd Academy Awards were announced. Across 20 acting categories, actress Cynthia Erivo was the only person of color nominated. Within minutes, the hashtag OscarsSoWhite was revived on Twitter. The hashtag first gained popularity back in 2015 when the Academy nominees were all white. Representation has been an issue in Hollywood for a long time. And for high school student Ashley Nguyen, movie portrayals of Asian American women are personal. She remembers growing up watching characters that looked like her being depicted as soft-spoken and passive. But that representation never matched up to how she saw herself and her family. So she wanted to know how and why these stereotypes came to be. In this piece from our archives.
When I was a little girl, I always went to the movies. My favorite films were always ones with girls saving the day. I always thought to myself, how can I be like her? But I soon realized that I couldn't because I didn't look like her. And if I did see someone that looked like me on screen, she was unheroic or she played the victim. But such portrayal doesn't represent me or the independent woman in my life. Meet my family.
I do everything.
That's my grandma. I call her Papa, which is Cantonese, for Grandma. She's a manager of a wholesale greenhouse center.
Badass Bach.
That's my mom's nickname at work. She's a San Francisco deputy sheriff.
I'm more than just a small little girl.
And my older sister, a waitress and a future nurse anesthesiologist. Growing up, I've seen these women defy the stereotypes that the media has created for Asian and Asian American women. You know, showing us as quiet, passive, subservient, and docile. So I asked my sister what she thinks of these portrayals.
Like, if you actually know Cantonese women, they're like the most like craziest people, you know? Like, when you go to family gatherings, they're the ones like yelling, like making things happen. So I feel like media doesn't correctly portray that.
My sister is right. It's safe to say that my family is one of the loudest, most extra families out there. But that kind of family isn't on TV. In fact, I rarely see Asians on the big screen. We're usually hidden in the background or kept as a side character.
Yeah, I guess they're just not expected to do much, you know, not to be a leader.
We're constantly underestimated, and that was especially true for my mom growing up here in San Francisco.
They would call me names, all this stuff, and they'd be trying to bully me.
But her classmates didn't expect her to stand out for herself.
It seems like talking to them doesn't work. So, yeah, we had to get into a few fights.
She's still a badass, and she's my role model. But since she's 5'2", she's underestimated at the workplace all the time.
The inmates always sizing you up, see if you get scared, nervous in any way. You just show that you're the one who's in charge.
My mom isn't the only one who's a boss. My grandma too. Literally, though.
They call me Dongwo.
Okay. That's my papa speaking Cantonese to her employees. They want to know if they could work another shift.
I work in Hamun Bay, so I organize for everything.
In 1982, my grandma came from Vietnam to America. When she first arrived, she worked at a sewing shop. Soon after, she was able to own her own sewing shop and a laundromat while raising 5 kids. But rent became too high, so she sold both places, and she's been working at Rocket Farms ever since.
Asian American women, I think they're 100% strong, or like put their life at stake to escape their country and to come to a new one, not knowing like what's on the other side, not knowing how they're even gonna live there.
That's my older sister again. She's another adventurous, free-spirited person in my life. And since the stereotypical Asian women on TV don't match up to the people I know, I called up a media expert, Professor L.S. Kim from UC Santa Cruz, to help explain why these stereotypes exist.
Quiet, docile, fragile, subservient. I mean, I'm curious, where did you come up with those words?
I don't know, it seemed like a good adjective on how they would, on how some movies would portray us.
Right, and think about it. I mean, you can ask yourself, like, why do you already know that that's how Asian American women are represented? It's because it's so prevalent. It's because it's such a powerful pattern. It's because it's been around for 100 years and has hardly changed.
Professor L.S. Kim told me that the first movie to show these Asian stereotypes was a 1922 movie called Toll of the Sea, featuring Anna May Wong. In short, it's about an Asian woman who falls in love with a white American man. They get married, have a kid, only to find out that he has another wife, who is white. And in the end, spoiler alert, she's heartbroken and takes her own life.
You know, that's not a very heroic or happy ending for the Asian female. That, again, it's about a certain powerlessness.
And these depictions of women who look like me as weak and self-sacrificing are no accident. Professor L.S. Kim explains how this came to be.
As our country and culture got more diverse, stereotypes are ways to maintain a certain social order, right? A certain social order in which some people maintain their status as privileged, and other people are kept, quote-unquote, in their place.
Meaning these stereotypes have real-life consequences. I walk down the street and people assume that they already know who I am because of these Hollywood stereotypes.
There isn't the same kind of freedom to express oneself, to represent oneself, and to be oneself.
I want to be able to see adventurous, risk-taking, sassy, strong, powerful Asian woman on the big screen. And if I want to see this happen, L.S. Kim says,
it takes a person in a position of power to hire an Asian American woman in a different kind of role. We need more characters and stories written and created. It has been so hard to get away from that stereotype created by non-Asians in the first place.
I realized that if I want to change media, I have to be a part of the change. In the future, I wish to pursue a career in film to prove that we aren't just some Hollywood stereotype. Now, I just have to break the news to my family.
So what do you think of me pursuing a career in media?
As long as you're happy, I was just hoping that you be the best at what you do, and I fully support your decision.
When you grow up, it's okay, but not now.
If you want it, you should go ahead and do it. Like, doesn't matter that it's not the traditional, like, doctor, lawyer. You do it enough and something you love, I'm pretty sure you're going to be successful in it.
With their support, it's finally time to direct that video game-inspired movie I've been planning with my friends. In San Francisco, I'm Ashley Nguyen for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Ashley. And if you want to hear more high school stories, we've got news for you. We're launching a new podcast by high school students. It's called TBH. That's short for To Be Honest. And it's launching February 11th. Check out a preview at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Our next story comes to us from StoryCorps. Jaina McRae is a dancer, and she first met singer David Dublin Schwartz during a rehearsal at San Francisco's Treat Street Social Club. They sat down together in the StoryCorps booth back in 2015 to share a few highlights of how their relationship evolved over time into love.
When is that moment that you sort of let somebody know that you are interested in them for real and would, you know, want to kiss them? The first time I ever saw you was at Treat Street Social Club on Treat Street in San Francisco. Oh. And you came in during a rehearsal and you were wearing sweatpants and like a sweatshirt or something. And one day you came up and talked to me and you lightly tapped me on the leg with your foot. It was intimate, sort of, and it was playful. And the thought went through my head, you know, I like this person. You know, who is this person? I should have just said right then, do you have a boyfriend or what? But I didn't. So we made a date to hang out.
And then instead of just being like, oh yeah, let's like meet for coffee and chat for an hour, you're like, yeah, like let's go on a hike. It takes about 3 hours. I was like, okay, he might be interested in me, but I didn't want to get my hopes up.
It might have been that day or just a few days before we went on the hike. You just lost your grandfather. And you talked about that. And your grandfather reminded me a lot of my grandfather. And we had like a pretty deep conversation. And there was such a, who this person, like, we're meant to be friends. We're meant to know each other.
And then the third date when we did actually kiss at that horrible show, or the like half horrible show.
It was world music hip hop, I guess. I don't know.
It was like fusion-y, like cumbia and salsa.
It was like it was 1997 or something. I don't know. It's just
not your bag, babe.
It wasn't. It's not my bag. And I look down at you, and where there's like people around us, and we're kind of like just drinking water, and so I'm just waiting this band out, and you're with me, and we just started kissing, and it was great, but so funny, because I was also wondering, does she like this group? Because this is the worst. But, and then we kissed outside for a long time. And
like, you were about to walk away, like we were sort of saying goodbye, and I was like, I really like you. And you said, you're like, really? Because I think I've liked you from the moment I met you. And I was just so excited. I was like so excited that it was so like clear and easy to tell each other that.
I just kind of feel like if I'm with somebody like you and I'm like being creative and I'm with and have a family, like, so it matters.
Yeah. You, I just feel like we could be in any situation together and we could deal with it so well together. You know, any situation. A zombie apocalypse. I don't know, just anything. Yeah, I'm just so sure of it and I'm so glad.
I love you.
Oh, I love you too.
Mic drop.
Turn them up.
On a night like this, Jaina and David shared their story at the San Francisco Library StoryCorps booth in 2015. Their interview was facilitated by Yosmai Del Maso and produced by KALW's Marlo McKenzie.
I could have told you, this city's grip will come
hold you,
crumble you up and then fold you, send you back across with your whole world cross. We hunt for beats among all the ghosts in the sunken streets, along with us here is breathing drunken heat, the only way to being someone's freak.
And we wanted to let you know our ongoing series, The Intersection at Burning Man. It's coming back in 2 weeks with a story about an art prank that delivered a bit of Burning Man to those who couldn't make it to the desert.
Hello from Black Rock City.
Well, that's incredible. Hello from Sao Paulo.
From where?
Sao Paulo, Brazil.
Oh, my gosh. We had no idea. I picked up the phone and talked to somebody, and I thought it was somebody here in the camp picking up the phone, but it was somebody out there.
That's coming up in 2 weeks. In the meantime, catch up on the podcast series at theintersection.fm or on any podcast player. And before we go, here's some local music. Billy Gale from Oakland. They're performing at the Golden Bull in their home city this Thursday. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Precious Green, Lisa Morehouse, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Sarah Lai Sterland. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adi. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.